How does an aviator train to be a test pilot? Is it based on the number of hours one has in the logbook? Is it experience in similar aircraft? Is it a thorough understanding of the airplane to be test flown? One pilot with thousands of hours felt he had the right stuff to test fly a type of airplane he'd never flown before. The plane looked great, a sexy paint job and sleek lines, but it's what he didn't know about the aircraft that almost killed him. Hidden problems on this episode of ILAFT. I learned about flying from that. Hello and welcome to episode 53 of Flying Magazine's I Learned About Flying From That podcast, brought to you by the Avemco Aviation Insurance Company. I'm Rob Ryder, and today we'll meet former Army aviator Jim Desmond. His time flying L-19 bird dogs in Vietnam gave him the confidence to test fly a 2/3-scale home-built Mustang. Everything he read about this kit plane indicated it would fly very well, but he didn't know the specs about this airplane. He learned the truth the hard way, and we'll hear about it right after this word from Avemco. Avemco insured their first plane in 1961. Ironically, that same Cessna 172 became Avemco's first claim. That's what started them on a mission to improve pilot safety. They even reward safe pilots with reduced premiums. You'll save 5% just for caring enough about safety to be an I Learned About Flying From That listener. Visit avemco.com/flying or call 800-338-8705 and ask an Avemco Aviation Insurance Specialist how you can save with the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Now, I learned about flying from that. My guest today on ILAFT has a unique story of being a test pilot, and it is said that every experimental aircraft flight is a test flight. Well, that may or may not be true, but it certainly was in this case, and it heaped a bunch of emergencies on this guest of mine that were incredibly challenging. Jim Desmond, thank you, and welcome to ILAFT.
Thank you, Rob. It's my pleasure to be here.
Your experience in the Mini Mustang that you flew, that you wrote about, and I learned about flying from that a number of years ago, is one that will scare almost anybody because of the number of failures. But you gained a lot of experience flying in the military. Tell me a little bit about how you got started through your aviation career, wound up in the military flying both fling-wing helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft.
Yes, I had enlisted in the Army after high school. My dad was career Air Force, and I had grown up on Air Force bases and really wanted to be a pilot, but didn't have the grades to get into the Air Force and didn't want to try to go to college and try to get a degree. The Air Force wouldn't have taken me into a pilot program without a degree. So I joined the Army intending to be an infantryman and jump out of airplanes. And then I happened to qualify for officer candidate school and accepted that. And once I was in that, somebody told me the Army had a flight program. And so as a brand new 19-year-old armor second lieutenant, I went to flight school at Fort Walters, Texas, and then off to Fort Rucker. Completed that program, had about 110 hours, I think, when I came out of flight school. Was on orders to go to Vietnam. And while I was on leave in Colorado, Colorado Springs, I was told to go see the FAA at the district standards office and went up there, and they looked at my records and converted my military rating into a commercial rotor wing with instrument. And I argued with the guy.
You argued? Why did you argue?
Well, because my instrument rating was what they called a tactical ticket, and it was designed to just give us enough instrument qualifications to fly out of bad weather. But it was, in fact, we were prohibited from using it in the States. We couldn't fly with that in FAA-controlled airspace. And the guy argued with the guy, and he said, no, it says instrument, so he wrote me an instrument ticket.
Oh, my goodness. I don't think that would happen today in a New York minute, would it?
No. So then I also was told that I could get my transition into private fixed wing by just getting enough hours to get 5 hours of solo, I think was a requirement at the time to change category. And so I went and joined the Peterson Air Force Base Flying Club. And I got enough dual to solo and got enough solo and passed a check ride. And so I went to Vietnam with a brand new private fixed wing and a commercial rotor wing. And I was on orders to the 1st Cavalry Division. And I had asked for that unit because there was a guy in my officer candidate class who had served there when they first went over, and he said they were a unit that had their act together. So I got to Vietnam, went to the 1st Cavalry Division, and I had asked for the 1st Squadron of the 9th Cavalry, which was the reconnaissance unit for that division. And the 1st and the 9th's job was to go out and find guys, fix them in place initially, and then the division would send more troops in to enlarge the battle.
So you were putting yourself in harm's way in a Bell 47 or an H-13 helicopter. That's got a big bubble canopy on the front. There's no protection in that aircraft.
No, there isn't. The later model scout aircraft, the OH-6, which we call the Loach, came with a armored seat similar to what they found in the Hueys. You had protection on the side and back and bottom. We just took a piece of armor plate and slid it under the seat cushion we sat on, and then slid a piece behind the seat cushion behind her back. And had really no protection from the front or the side, other than we wore a chest protector.
Did you ever get shot down?
I flew for 10 months in scouts. I always managed to get the helicopters back. Had a lot of them shot up. Had a bullet come through the bubble canopy from head on, went through the radio panel, came out of the radio panel, went between me and the door gunner, and between us was a 50 caliber ammo box full of hand grenades.
And
the round went through that box of hand grenades and exited the back, and we found it later stopped against the cylinder head on the engine. When we unpacked the grenade box, we found that the round had just kind of snaked its way, made its way around the sides of the grenades, and we could see lead marks on the grenades. And in that box was fragmentation grenades and white phosphorus grenades, and so really could have been an ugly moment, but I had incredible luck over there.
That's one of those things, and I hate to use this term, you literally dodged the bullet. Had those grenades gone off, there would be no saving you.
Nope. And I had another really lucky moment, again, flying in an H-13. It was during the battle for Quezon, and a unit asked me if I could find a sniper that was harassing him, and I said, yeah, you bet. And I flew over there, and a sniper promptly shot me. The round came up through the bottom of the aircraft, came right through the base of the cyclic control stick, hit me in the hand as it exited through the bubble, and it was an exceedingly lucky moment for me because I happened to be stretching at the time, and I was leaning my head back. Otherwise, where my usual head position, the round would have hit me in the hand and then hit me in the forehead. Didn't do that, so I'm lucky enough to be here talking to you today.
Well, I'm glad you're here to talk to me today. But your experience went into a lot of time flying L-19 bird dogs as well. And so let's move on now, because that the time that you had flying bird dogs gave you that tail dragger experience to work with a partner in the Mustang, this mini Mustang that you wrote about. Tell me a little bit about the mini Mustang and its motor and how different it was than a full-scale P-51.
Well, this was a, I think it was a Sturgeon Air Limited SAL Mustang. It was a two-thirds scale. It had a 200-horsepower Ranger engine in it instead of the 1,400-some horsepower Merlin. But the specs on it, it was a home-built. The one I attempted to fly was bought by a guy that I was in partnership with on a PA-12 Piper Super Cruiser that had a 150-horse engine in the PA-12 and flaps and so on. It was flew in similar way to the Bird Dog. So this Mustang, the spec sheet on it said that it was going to have a pretty high cruise speed. It had a not-to-exceed speed that was higher than anything I'd ever flown. And it just looked like it should go like mad. I mean, I saw it first when it was in a rust-colored primer, and then when it was finished and so on, my friend had bought it from the owner-builder who had landed it gear up.
Ew.
So my friend had bought it and had a mechanic that was also the mechanic that worked on our PA-12 and who did an excellent job on the PA-12. This mechanic was working on the repairs and so on. And they made some decisions, which I can talk about in the lessons learned part of this, that weren't good for the airplane or for me. But it looked like it was just going to go like blue blazes. I had never flown a Ranger engine, and that was a bad deal. I should have known more about those. The thing had a two-speed prop, which I was told had come off of an Navion. The first attempt to fly the thing, it just wasn't accelerating. I was at the Fort Collins downtown airport, which was an airport that was about just under 5,000 MSL, had a 5,300-foot long paved runway, but it was a narrow runway. The takeoff direction we were going was southeast, and it aimed toward Highway 14, which is a main highway out of Fort Collins. And, of course, there were power lines and trees and stuff along that highway.
Ooh.
So the first attempt to take off, it wasn't accelerating. It felt heavy. It just wasn't doing what it should. I got the tail up, and I boarded the takeoff and taxied back. And I tried a second time, and I got the same thing, and I boarded the takeoff and taxied back. And I was seeing 3,000 RPM on the tack on the takeoff attempts. And I said something to the owner, and he said, oh, no, that's what it's supposed to be. Well, there was a guy in the crowd that walked up, and he said, no, that's about 450 higher than the max RPM on that Ranger engine. And the problem is probably in the prop.
Oh, boy.
So they pulled the prop that day and got it to a prop shop and repitched the prop and put it back on. And the next day I was back out there ready to do it again. My wife of 6 months was there to watch, and along with a crowd of the friends of ours and friends of the owners.
This was going to be the maiden flight of this freshly painted Mustang.
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, boy.
And beautifully painted it was. Shiny silver, you know. I mean, it just looked gorgeous. I could hardly wait to get in this thing to fly it. And so I started down the runway, and I was accelerating a little better. Still wasn't great. And I had the tail up, and I had the speed that I had set in my mind for rotation. I had all my
speeds.
And
what is V1 in it? What was V1 in that?
I think I was looking for 80 or 85 miles an hour.
Okay.
And I had that, and I had to make a decision. And I was about, I mean, I could have aborted and stopped, but I went ahead and rotated, and I got up about 20 feet, and the canopy blew off.
Whoa.
yeah. And paint chips and debris from the floor blew up in my face, momentarily blinded me. I started to look behind me to see if it had damaged the tail, and I thought, nope, your problems are in front of you. And I was at the time a flight instructor at an outfit on that same airport, and I was writing a newsletter for them, and I had written an article about, you know, keep flying the airplane and don't worry about things that have happened. And so I stayed focused forward, and my next challenge was the highway was coming up, and there were some trees, and I said little power lines. I managed to get up and over that, and our plan had been to leave the gear down, fly the airplane off of Fort Collins downtown, and go 15 miles south to the Fort Collins Loveland Airport, where there was a much wider runway. I was worried about the skinny runway coming back in for the landing with that high nose and the tail dragger. And even though I was flying tail draggers, this one really had more obstructed forward view in the tailwheel down attitude than the other two I had flown. And so that we were going to go to Fort Collins Loveland. We were going to leave the gear down. Well, I got over the power line. There was a creek area that ran through there, and I just went kind of back into Army nap of the earth flight mode and stayed in the air, but used the descending terrain to give up altitude and get a little more airspeed. And I said, something's got to give.
How fast were you flying at that point, Jim?
I think I had best rate of climb, which I think was about 95, and it wasn't climbing. And I said, well, I got to get the gear up.
Before we talk about the gear coming up, let me ask you this. Are you thinking that maybe it didn't get to that speed because of the increased drag of the canopy being gone?
No, I think it was just a doggy airplane. And
all right, so you went to put the gear up.
Yeah, yeah. And funny, when the canopy blew off, I did have another thought. I thought, well, it's going to be easier to get out of the wreckage when I crash this thing.
So
that's a good thing. And so I select gear up, and of course it's noisy with the canopy off, and the gear was exceedingly slow. And I thought, oh, this is great. It's not coming up. And I saw a shadow. I could see the shadow of the left gear. And I thought, great, now I'm going to have one up and one down. You know, what else could go wrong?
Well, the gear
eventually came up. There was a sand and gravel pit off that end of the runway, and I had flown over that a lot of times because I flew out of there every day. And I had never thought that dredge tower was so tall, but I had never approached it at 50 feet before.
Goodness.
And so I steered around that, and I looked at the downtown airport, which was, as I said, 15 miles south, and there was a 100,000-volt power line between me and it. And I said, well, I can't get over it, and I'm too chicken to go under it, so I'm going to have to turn and go back to Fort Collins. And so I made the most gradual turn I could make away from that power line. I was afraid I was going to turn this thing and stall it. But I got it turned. I flew it very carefully. I got it. My wife said that when we disappeared over the trees, the collective crowd did a big inhale and then waited for the crash.
Oh.
And she said, here I came wobbling back a few minutes later at about a 150 or 200 foot downwind. And I had nursed it up to that. And at one point, as I was, and I knew the runway or the airport so well, I knew that once I got into that downwind, even if I lost everything, there was places alongside the runway to put it down. They had a sod strip alongside the runway, and they had a lot less development around the runway at that time. And I was committed to just put it down somewhere if I had to. But I, somewhere on that downwind, I looked and I had cylinder head temp was at the red line. Oil temp was at the red line. Oil pressure was 20 below what it's supposed to be. And I thought, well, don't look at that anymore because it didn't do any good to look at that. So I continued on and I turned base and I was trying to decide what to do with the gear. And when I made the base to final turn, I selected gear down and I said to myself, up, down, or in between your landing. You know, this is your only option. You don't have a go around in this thing, so you're landing. And again, it was exceedingly slow coming down. I joked later that it must have been an electric shaver motor that was powering the gear.
Oh.
And right before I was to round out, I noticed the shadow of the left gear, and I was gear down, and I had the lights. And so I went ahead and flared, touched down, and let me tell you, Rob, the airplane was as happy to be on the ground as I was. And there was no problem. I was worried about controlling this thing on the landing on a skinny runway. That was not a problem at all.
Good.
My wife said
it probably, you know, because of the wide gear on the Mustang. You know, it was way wider than for the Mustang than it was on the T6s that the pilots in World War II flew. So it was it handled much better. But anyway, I'm sorry for interrupting. But so it was happy to be on the ground too.
Yeah, it handled fine, and we taxied up to the hangar, and the guy that owned it was so embarrassed the minute I shut the engine down, he grabbed it and drug it into the hangar and shut the door, and then we're trying to figure out what had gone wrong. My wife was very calm until I got out of the airplane. She grabbed me by the lapels and screamed in my ear something to the effect of, was that as dangerous as it looked, and why are you doing this? But we were back on the ground, all was well, And I hadn't, as I thought I was going to, destroyed the airplane. Got it back, absent the canopy, but I got everything else back.
Did they ever find the canopy? If it was 20 feet off, must still have been on the airport property.
Yeah, I think they did. To be honest, the owner and I didn't ever talk about this again. And like I said, he and I were partners in the PA-12 year or so. This happened in October of 81. And in 83, I went back into the Army and left, and I bought out his share of the airplane, took the airplane with me, and had it for until 2000. But we just kind of never talked about it again. I talked to the mechanic afterwards, and that's where I learned some things about the airplane that I should have known before I flew it.
Well, tell you what, let's take a break. We'll come back and discuss those things and what you learned about flying from that. We'll be right back. Avemco is the only aircraft insurance company that lets you call them directly. In fact, they want you to call them. They love talking about airplanes. And if you've got a squawk with your insurance company, even if it's with Avemco, they want to hear about it. It's that direct, one-on-one, personal contact that sets Avemco apart. Visit avemco.com/flying or call them today at 800-338-8705. Say you're and I learned about flying from that listener, and you'll save 5% on your annual premium. Now, back to ILAF. We are back with Jim Desmond, who experienced an incredibly dangerous and harrowing flight in that Mini Mustang. And as you wrote in the article back many years ago, Jim, you experienced more emergencies in that one flight than you did in 3,000 hours of military flying. What did you learn about flying from that?
Well, there were a bunch of things. In terms of the actual flight, I did some things right. I kept flying the airplane. I didn't succumb to the temptation to look behind me when the canopy may have hit the empennage. I just kept flying the airplane. I kept it in the air. And I think the military low-level flight was really a benefit there because I wasn't afraid to go cruising through the trees. I had done a lot of that. I adjusted my plan. As I said earlier, my plan was to take this thing to a big, wide airport to land. And when I knew that wasn't going to happen, I just adjusted the plan and went back to the skinny airport that I thought was going to give me a problem. When I saw the temps rising on the oil in the cylinder head, I just said, that's not a problem anymore. Just keep flying it till it quits. And then I had a plan for if the engine quit on downwind, I was going to put it on the airport property. And then when I got around to final and asked for the gear to come down, I was committed to land and I was going to land whether the gear was up, down, or in between. And I was going to deal with all that way. And I was going to fly the thing through the wreckage. You know, I've heard that said by Bob Hoover years ago.
Indeed, we have.
Yeah. I read a book years ago, probably written in the 30s or 40s by a guy that made his living crashing old biplanes for the movies. And he had laid that out very clearly in that book, you know, just keep hitting things and slow yourself down as over as long a period of time as you can. And so I was committed to do that. I had a lot of previous flight experience, as you said, and that was all a benefit. You know, I'd been shot at and missed and shot at and hit, and I was used to dealing with adrenaline situations. And so all of that came to help out. I was flying daily. In the previous month, I'd flown Hueys and Queen Airs and airplanes from the civilian world and so on. And so flying was something I did every day. So those were the kind of during the event things. So what did I do wrong? Well, I made the assumption that that I could fly this thing based on the variety of aircraft I'd flown and I was currently flying. And I did fly it and I didn't crash it, but I made an assumption that I shouldn't have made. You know, I wasn't a test pilot. I didn't spend a lot of time checking out the airplane, and that came back to almost really seriously bite me. After the fact, and talking to the mechanic, I learned some things. The original airplane was wood, and this was wood underneath the stuff. The original airplane was wood, and the wood was covered with fiberglass fabric and then doped. And when my partner bought this thing, he decided it would look really slick if they put fiberglass in addition to the fiberglass fabric. So what I was looking at, this sleek-looking airplane, was fiberglass that they'd put, and that was not the original design factor, and it made the airplane heavier.
And did it not only make it heavier, but it also had to have changed the flight characteristics of the wing itself and the way it flew?
Yes, I believe it did. And I found out from talking to the mechanic that it did change the CG, and they had to add weight in the tail to get the thing back into CG, but I didn't know any of that. So the aircraft was heavier than the normal SAL Mustang. And then when I looked at it in comparison, I was doing a lot of flying in Cessna products, and I had a lot of 172 time. So I compared it to a 172. It had less wing area than a 172. I think it was like 40 or 50% of the wing area of a 172, probably close to the same weight and comparable horsepower. You know, and it just didn't fly. It was not the airplane that whoever designed this SAL Mustang had designed or that the original builder had built. So had I looked at all of that stuff, had I really researched what I was getting ready to do, I don't think I'd have flown it. But all that was after the fact, and I'm just exceedingly lucky to have survived all of that and had the opportunity then to go back and look at what I should have looked at first.
You said that your wife yelled at you. Did it look, was it as scary as it appeared to be? Has she ever flown with you since?
Oh yeah. She was a flight student of mine for a while. after we got married, I was teaching her in a Tomahawk, and then she had some sort of an issue and couldn't get a medical, and didn't fly, but we've flown long, long trips in the PA-12. We took a trip one year from Fort Collins to the San Francisco Bay Area in the middle of the winter for a Christmas visit. And she's been with me landings on Whidbey Island when we were stationed at Fort Lewis. So, yeah, she's flown with me for years. She was with me when I landed the PA-12 at Fort Missoula in Missoula.
That's cool.
And so, no, she she has no problem with flying and had no problem flying with me, but she was watching the faces of all these guys who knew aviation when they saw me disappear into the trees on the other side of the highway. And nobody was saying anything because they knew she was my wife and nobody was saying anything. And she was thinking, all right, they were all waiting for the crash, and they were.
And fortunately, that didn't happen. Are you still flying?
No, unfortunately, I had the PA-12, and I also, thanks to my wife, got involved in equestrian sports. We ride jumping horses. And I was at a horse show in Jackson, Wyoming, and I was getting on a horse, and something went wrong, and I ended up tearing my Achilles tendon on my left leg. And so I had surgery. I was looking at 6 weeks with not any weight on it. I was looking at a long period of rehab. At the same time that I did that, my airplane was due a biannual. I was due a biannual flight review. The airplane was due an annual, and I was due a medical. And well, I had been doing my annuals up in Ferndale, Montana for years, and so I would have had to fly the airplane up there, and it just wasn't going to work out for a number of reasons, and so I sold the airplane. I intended then, when I got recovered, to get back into flying, and life kind of got in the way. One thing led to another, and I just never got back into flying. I regret it. I was out at the county I worked for on Tuesday night, and watched a guy doing landings at the Murphy Airport, and I'm the manager of the Murphy Airport, and I thought, you know, I really should get to do this again one or two more times before I'm gone, because I do love it.
Well, I think you should, but thank you so very, very much for sharing this story. It's interesting how when we want to fly, sometimes we overlook some of those things that should be obvious, but boy, oh boy, you were one lucky guy.
Yes.
And, oh, by the way, did that Mustang ever fly again?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think that that the guy kept it. I think the reason I got to fly it was that his wife wouldn't let him fly it. And so I think when all this happened, he just parted with it. So
I hear you.
You know, I worked at Fort Lewis for a general named Calvin Waller, who was a great guy, and he was the number two under Schwarzkopf in the first Gulf War. And General Waller had an expression. He said, if you got to have something in the worst way, that's how you're going to get it. Well, I had to fly that airplane in the worst way, and that's how I got it.
Interesting stuff. Well, that's a good way to end the episode. And Jim Desmond, I really appreciate that you reached out with your article to me to be here on I Laughed. Thank you for being on I Laughed.
And thank you for having me, Rob. I really enjoyed it.
As harrowing as Jim Desmond's story is, just 1 month later, with two passengers aboard a Cessna 207, he experienced an engine problem while taking off from the same runway. He had to fly the same route as he did in the ILAFT incident, and like before, he brought the plane to a safe landing. I'd like to hear your ILAFT story. If you've had an incident in which you learned some valuable lessons, send me a synopsis and I'll take a look at it. My email address is rob@flying.media. rob@flying.media. I Laughed is available wherever you get your podcasts, and I hope you'll subscribe. You can also go to flyingmag.com and click on podcasts. We drop episodes every couple of weeks, so you can hear the firsthand accounts of the flying lessons that sometimes only experience can teach. Julie Boatman is editor-in-chief of Flying Magazine, and Lisa DeFries is the executive producer of I Laughed. The I Laughed theme and commercial instrumental music for the podcast were written and performed by Rob Potorf. For Avemco Aviation Insurance and Flying Magazine, fueling the passion for flight since 1927, I'm Rob Ryder. Catch you next time on I Learned About Flying From That.